Alan Kring Productions presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 2 for Autumn Semester 2018. Lecture 18, delivered on October 25, 2018. The title of this lecture is Measures of Risk.
Today, Measures of Risk. Before I do that, I want to show you something interesting that's going on with the yield curve. And here, the Treasury yield curve chart, we're going to look at the current month. Now, remember that I've been watching this 7-year notch. At the 7 to 10 year, I'm looking for the 7-year to yield to go above the 10 year. If anything, it's not happening. It's actually pulling away from that. But suddenly it occurred to me, wait a minute. Look at the 1 to 2 month. That's not going to be significant because it's only a month spread. 2 to 3 month, 1 to 2 month is a 3 basis point spread. That's trivial. 2 to 3 month is an 11 basis point spread. The 3 month to 6 month is a 13 basis point spread. The 6 month to 1 year is what? A 14. No, that's not true. That's 17 basis point spread. And then you go to 1 to 2 year, you've got a 20 basis point spread. Oh, whoa. 2 to 3. 5 basis point spread, 3 to 5, 5 basis point spread. And then it opens back up 5 to 7. You've got an 8 basis point spread. Look what's happening. The inversion has moved from possibly the 7 to 10 year down here in the 2 to 3 or the 3 to 5. In other words, the yield curve is actually arching upward in the longer debt paper, because all interest rates are rising rather rapidly now. But in the shorter paper, it's actually getting narrower. So what we might see is an inversion in the shorter end of the yield curve rather than where it typically occurs in the longer end of the yield curve. That's an oddity, and that's a very bad sign. But then again, there are a lot of other bad signs right now, too. I've talked to you a lot about risk and return in the sense that it's not that hard to get the concept of beta. And I also, just the idea that risk is what we need if we want a better expected return. Now, you might be, are you a risk taker, a risk lover, or are you a risk hater? No. What is it?
I'm not a risk taker.
You're not a risk taker. As a matter of fact, most people are not risk takers. They are not risk lovers. They don't want risk. But there are people and institutions that do, because that's how you make your money. You, madam, are not going to make your money being an agoraphobic and hiding in your house and saying, I can't adult, I will stay in my house forever and ever. Turn off the TV, turn off the phones, and everything. You won't make much money doing that. Although there is that one creepy guy on YouTube for the last, 10 years. Every day he sits for, 8 hours motionless in front of his camera doing YouTube. He's got a huge following, and he makes a lot of money doing that. I don't know why. But if you want to make money, you're going to have to take risk. And if you want to make a lot of money, you've got to take a lot of risk. That's just how the world works. And so that's why you are here. You're taking a risk because you want to make more than you would working at Walmart. Although there's nothing wrong with Walmart. There is. I look at the people there, God, these people are weird, and then I realize I'm here. Okay. There are different kinds of risk. It's important for you to know that there are different kinds of risk. Now, we want to measure risk, obviously. And the way we do it, actually, our most typical way of measuring volatility is just plain old standard deviation. Standard deviation, the spread of possible outcomes. So if I look at stocks, I will just measure the standard deviation. Now, back in the day, I would have had you calculate it by hand the way we did. But now you can actually just put data into an Excel vector. A vector is a fancy term for a column of data. Just put it in there, and at the bottom, just type equals STDEV, and then the column. Now, there are two variations on, and I don't have a marker that just rotates my butt. Ah. They stole the marker. I hit a marker right there. You know what? Ah. God, that just bunches my boxers. Really? I don't have a marker. Oh, you will get a point for that. I'm not worthy of your contempt. So if you've got a column of data, there are two things that you could do. One of them is you could say at the bottom equals, let's say your data is in cells A1, A1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and you've got A, B, C, etc. And you've got data, let's say here in column A, like this. Now, one thing you could do is you could say equals STDEV, and then A1 through A4. Now that will give you a sample standard deviation. If you actually have the population of data, all of the data that could possibly be, everything is measured, then you would want to use STDEV.P, A1:A4. You are actually only rarely going to have that level of comprehensive data. Almost always you're going to use a sample standard deviation. Now the fancy term for that would be, this one is the sum from I equals 1 to N of the data points X of I minus the average squared over N minus 1. The sample would use N minus 1. The population would be the same. Oh, standard deviation would be the square root of that mess. And this one is I equals 1 to N of the X sub I minus the average of them, each one squared, over N. And it would be the square root of that mess. Now, in statistics, we usually call the sample S and the population sigma. But they don't do that much in business. They just call it all sigma. But if you ever step into real probability theory, real statistics courses, you would see this designation of S representing the sample standard deviation. That's the one we usually use. So in other words, if you're doing this in Excel, which you should in some of those homework problems, it's a lot better, it's a lot less likely you'll make a mistake. You use the STDEV A1 through A4. Okay? So there's this measure of risk. However, That doesn't really capture some types of risk. We can't really, in some cases, say, okay, risk is measured by the spread along a normal curve. Well, that's one level of risk, and then maybe one that hikes up like that, that's another level of risk. This one would have less risk than this one overall because the spread of possible outcomes is less on this one than it is on that one. However, there are other measures of risk that we have to consider, especially in certain types of finance, like insurance. We have to be awfully careful when we start talking about risk. And for that, I have to show you something here, very important. I want to turn on the projector here and show you. Now, I do apologize because I'm going to have to use somebody in the class to for this demonstration. Document camera. Why is my document camera looking weird? There it is. Okay, let me show you something. Do you see these? What are those? They're not just dragons. These are miniature dragons. You see them? Look at this one. Okay. Those are dragons. Okay. Little miniature dragons. Okay, so now we have to move to the issue at hand. They're attacking. And they attack. Oh, I want my dragons back. You were attacked by a bunch of dragons. Frequency. A lot of dragons attacked you. But they were mini dragons. Now, let's talk about severity. Giant dragon. Wait. Fire breathing dragon. Oh, my beard! Wait. I caught my beard on fire. Oh, God, that was nasty. What the hell was all that? Okay, frequency versus severity. Please. Do you understand frequency versus severity? In the first one, frequency, but they were minor, little mini dragons. In the second one, it was a giant fire-breathing dragon.
It's terrifying.
Yeah, I know, right? I mean, it was a little. Where the hell was it? Oh, do you understand? Boy, that melted. You know, I use beard wax, and that just melted that son of a... Okay, where? Okay, now you understand what is I'm talking about is that, you see, some risks are quite likely to occur, but they are trivial. But some will happen only once in a great while, but they have a great deal of impact. So in other words, that's really not captured in the typical model that we teach in finance. So for example, you could have frequency, for example. There are small objects that hit skyscrapers all the time. You know, little meteorites, stones flying off the curbs and sidewalks and roads around skyscrapers. Frequency is very high. However, how many times does an airplane strike a building? As a matter of fact, there was one thing that was interesting. The towers, the two towers, one of them was insured. They insured one because the probability of one getting knocked down, destroyed, was extraordinarily small. So the idea that two could go down at once, well, there's no way that could happen. There's an old story about a guy who driving down a road, and this young hitchhiker, he picks up a young hitchhiker, and a kid climbs in the car. It's in the, at night, and he says, "I really appreciate you picking me up because, you know, most people don't because they think, you know, I could be a serial killer, a mass murderer." And the driver said, "Well, not really, because what would be the probability that there would be two serial killers in this car?" Don't hitchhike. Okay. Now, anyway, use Excel to do these problems. Find the average, the expected risk. And then from the average, you need to have the average to get this. However, if you're in Excel, it will grab the answer for you. I want to bring up something interesting to you, and I'm going to do a problem in Excel. I'm going to show you how to capture a data set, if I possibly can. Sometimes these computers get really touchy when they're reaching out for external data and pulling it. But I'm going to give that a try here in a minute. One problem that I'll bring up with the standard model for finding risk in business is that you all took a statistics course. I'm sure they showed you the normal distribution and all that kind of stuff. Wonderful. That's fine. There's a problem with the assumption that the distribution of stock returns or stock prices, but especially stock returns, there's a problem with the idea that the distribution is normal. You see, because with a normal distribution, there is a positive probability, wherever your average is, your X bar, whatever, X bar, the little X with a bar, that's a sample average. In statistics, the population average would be the Greek letter mu, mu. But anyway, X bar. There's a problem that stock prices can't be normally distributed. Stock returns could be, but stock prices most definitively cannot be normally distributed because stock price, the normal distribution, assumes that there could be infinitely negative stock prices because any normal distribution goes on forever in both directions. It's impossible for stock prices to be negative, although Lord knows some companies have tried. But so a normal distribution is probably inappropriate if you're just looking at stock prices. With stock returns, however, it's okay to do that. However, do be careful. There's another measure. X bar or mu, whatever you want to look at, is called central tendency. If you take some higher level statistics courses, it's the first moment of the probability density function. I think that's what it is. But anyway, there is another measure of central tendency, which is actually sometimes more useful, but it's also good to look at them together. It's called the median. The median is the place in the data where half of the data lies below that place, and half of it lies above that place. So, for example, when I give you an exam, I might find that the average of the data is a 78, and the median, which sometimes you'll see it with an X with a little hat on it, the median of the data is, interestingly enough, a 74. Now, if it's a perfectly normal distribution, the mean and the median are identical. This tells me, no, the data was not normally distributed. But it tells me, it tells me a lot more than that. See this? 78, the average. But the median is 74. What that tells me is that there were a few people who scored very high on the test, and they skewed the average upward. They actually caused the average to be higher than half of the data. When the median is below, when the average is above the median, there are some few data points that are abnormally pulling the average up. When the average is below the median, there are a few data points that are pulling the average down. So for example, on this last one, the final result was that X bar was 76 and X hat was 80. And that was easy to figure out. Oh, there are some people who just absolutely screwed the test. They just they got virtually zeros. And what they did was they just hauled the average down. Those few very low scores made the average look worse than it really, the central tendency. And what will happen, interestingly enough, is as the semester goes on and more tests are taken, these two numbers will tend to converge. Ultimately, by the end of the course, usually I will see a situation where the average is about 80 and the median is about 78.5 to 79. Why does that happen? This is where you have to think. Numbers mean nothing unless you can explain what the heck the number is saying to you. Why does it start out with the average below the median, but by the end, the average is just a little bit above? Really, they're pretty close. Why? Yeah. Not just lower scores, something else, but you're on the right track. You're on the right track. You got a 21 on my first exam. You got a 35 on my second exam. What are you going to do? You're going to drop my course. You're going to drop that like a hot potato and say FTS. That's instructorsucks.com. I'm going to nail him on Rate My Professor. And I'm going to say hurtful things about him on Snapchat. And I'm going to Photoshop images of him and put them up on Facebook. Yeah, that's what you're going to do. Don't ever believe anything you see about me on Facebook. It's a lie. Okay. No, seriously, noob. No, that, some of that stuff, that can't have anyway. What is going to happen is you're going to have what's called a sorting effect. This is true in stock returns, too. You will tend to see companies vanish that have lower returns. And so over time, you will, in long-term data, which is different, actually gives you a different answer than short-term data, in longer-term data, you will find that, interestingly enough, you will have companies vanishing. So that gives you actually kind of an incorrect view of what the risk of investment is. Because in the long run, you won't see all the loser companies. Just like in the long run, you will think, well, I want to be an entrepreneur. Let me look at all these companies that have started from nothing. Wow, this is all so cool. What you're doing is you're seeing survivors. You're not seeing all of the short-term players that got nailed and knocked out of the ball game. Same is true with stock investing. All you ever hear about are the day traders who won. You never hear about the ones who lost, and they either don't talk about it or they just killed themselves because they were so stupid and they did humanity a favor. I shouldn't say that. Yeah, I should. Come on. Now, watch. I want to show you something here. I'm going to see if I can do this. And again, I can't promise. These computers give me are dodgy with me sometimes about this. But the first thing that I want to do is I want to go to a site and see if I can find if they're still running this. Oops, I didn't mean to do that. Historical returns. Y charts should have what I want. Yeah, that one's not good. That one's going to be really, really not what I want. What I'm looking for is a clean, what we call a clean data vector. There we go. That should do it. That should do it. This is the Standard & Poor's 500 from 1928 to 2015. Okay, and I want this data vector. Now, the thing you're going to do is you're going to, this is seeking alpha, copy. Okay, I'm going to copy this URL, the address. Now, the next thing I'm going to do is I'm going to open up an Excel spreadsheet, okay? Like I said, sometimes I can do this. Other times these computers don't let me access external data. What I'm going to do is show you how to do a data poll. In other words, your lives are going to be heavily involved in big data. Here is how you grab big data off the internet. Now remember, be careful about where you go on the internet because you could be getting big data from a site that is run by a bunch of malevolent cats. Anyway, so we're going to go data, external data, from the web. Now, the first thing you got to do is say, I tell it the URL of this data. That's why I copied that URL. There. Now, the next thing that's going to happen is that Excel is going to bitch at you. Watch. Script error. Say just. Yes. Yes. Two? I'm disappointed. Okay, you see these little arrows? This is where Excel is finding data. Now, this is just stupid data. The menu bar is stupid data. Let's go down and see if it found data anywhere else. Really? Well, I locked up. Oh, okay. Whew. Nope, I am locked. It locked that much. That thing, it just locked that up really bad on me. Click there. Oh, that's got a script. Tell me what to do. Tell me what you're seeing here. Yes, that one? Okay. Oh, no, it wants me to, that's selecting the whole stupid page. Shoot, it's not going to let me scroll down on this.
Can you just drag that bottom right corner and make it bigger?
You mean right here?
Yeah, just make it bigger.
Well, I could do, let me, no, it's frozen. It crashed. Shoot. Really? Let me do this again. Cancel. I said cancel. Yep, I have crashed this like the Titanic into an iceberg. But if you were to do this, see, the problem is if on your own computers, you'll probably be able to do this. And I wish it would not make such a fuss. It is. That thing has crashed. Cancel. Okay. Import. Yeah, I'm going to have to do Task Manager and get out of this. Control, Alt, Delete, Task Manager. Yep. Exit that task. Okay, let's try that one more time, just in case. You know, if it doesn't work once, do it again just to irritate the hell out of yourself. File. No, I mean data, external data. I'll show you another way. I'm going to show you another way here you can do it if it doesn't work. From the web, paste, go. Wonder if it wants me to say no. Yes, I do want you to run a script on this page. Yes, I do. Now, yep, crash that mother. Okay, Task Manager. I'll show you the other way you can do it. This is the cheater's way of doing it. Watch. Okay. Now, what I'm going to do this time, I'm going to open up Excel. Here's the way you can get around that problem if you have it. Okay, go back to that data vector. See that data vector right there? Watch. I'm just going to highlight the whole thing all the way down. And then, now you might have to do some data cleaning on this. Copy. And then you put it right into your data. Paste. Yeah, there we go. Well, you're saying, well, why did you do that the first time? Well, the reason you would want to do it as a data pull is so that as the data got updated, you could reestablish the data from the web address itself. It would constantly go back there to see if there was other data. Okay, so now, anyway, you notice I've got my data right here. I'm in good shape. So the next thing I can do, well, let me spread these two columns out here a little bit. And what I can do here is I can say average equals, and then you just simply average your data B1 through B89. And I'm doing this to make a point here. I don't want to bore you with this, but oh, okay. B89, talking and doing this at the same time isn't a good idea. Okay, there's your average. Now, let me format a couple of, well, I'll do that later. Now, the standard deviation. And in this case, that would equal STDEV, not with the dot P, just the standard deviation of the sample. And that would be B2. Actually, that's B2, wasn't it? Yeah, B2 through B89. I should fix that up there. I think it's probably not going to see that data value there, but. Okay, so now the standard deviation is also a percentage. Okay, copy. But rather format the cell. Percentage. The standard deviation is 19. I'm going to show you another metric, but first of all, I'm going to insert something here. I want to see what the median of this data is. Equals median of B2 through B89. Oh, look at that. This, by the way, is a long period. 89 data points is a good, good, hard sample. What the heck? Do you see that the stock returns on the Standard & Poor's 500 are not normally distributed? Because if they were, the mean and the median would be sitting right on each other. It would be a perfectly symmetrical bell curve. But in this case, if you look, the median is above the average. What does that mean? I know I just told you this a few minutes ago. Can you interpret it? Yes. Yes. In other words, the median is above the average, so the average is being pulled down by some really heavy down year annual returns. That's what this is telling us, is that although on average you are going to get an 11.41% return, you could get a butt beating, because there are apparently some years where the returns were stunningly negative. So where are they talking about? What are they talking about here with these highly negative returns? Well, let's go back here. Look, 1928, 43.81, and then the next year, by the way, what was 1929? Anything important about 1929? Anything? Yeah, the stock market crashed in 29. That was the beginning of the Great Depression. Okay, so you had this awesome year. Yay, look at 2017. It was great. Yay. Oh, God, what's happening in 2019? You see, this has happened before. Historically, this has happened before. A big, big boost year. And at that time, the president was Hoover. And he was just, he was very, you know, I look at my stock market as the election of 28 came in. Everyone said, okay, fine, great, wonderful. And then all of a sudden, hell broke loose. 29, negative 8.3. 1930, negative 25.12. 1931, negative 43.84. And then we got into, he was kicked out of office. And all of the members of Congress of his party were kicked out of office. I mean, it was a bloodbath. And we had the major correction in 33. But you see those heavy, strong down years? You have up years, but when you have a down year, I mean, you have some strings of down years here, it tended to cause that rather strong difference between the median and the mean. Now, I'm going to show you another metric here. Let me show you another one. This one is called the coefficient of variation. The CV, as it were. Now, the CV is nothing but the standard deviation scaled by the average. What did I do there? I did that wrong, didn't I? Yes. Okay. Equals the standard deviation equals that scaled by the average. Now, here's what that does. And that's not a percentage. That's a number. Format the cells. Just a number, two decimals. That makes it so that the size of the standard deviation is scaled by the average in this way. Look, if I have a variation of 20%, and an average of 40. That's very different from a variation of 20% on an average of 10. So in other words, this allows us to look across markets. Because, for example, and I'm going to try to do this, see if I can pull another data set here. Hang on. Was that the one I used? That was Seeking Alpha. which I try to avoid seeking alpha. I was looking, hoping I could find the one for the Standard & Poor's 500. For the NASDAQ. Yeah, that's not the one I want for that. Let me see if I can find the NASDAQ. Is that the one I want? One-in-one stock. Oh, here's the one I wanted to begin with. Okay. Oh, look at that. Isn't that pretty? That's got all the data at once in it. Let me tall this down here. And this got cleared in last year. Control-C. And then I'm going to go back to my drop that one real fast. Oh, good. Look at that. Oh, isn't that pretty? All of the stock data. So I can... Okay, so now what I can do is I can do it across average, median, standard deviation, coefficient of variation, CV. And I'm going to do them all so you can see all of them. And you're going to see something remarkable begin to occur here. Okay, so the average equals... average of, that's B2 through B44, B2, B44 equals median B2 through B44. Equals standard deviation B2 through B44, and then the coefficient of variation equals the standard deviation divided by the average. Now let me get some of these numbers. Average and median and standard deviation are all percentages. Percents to two decimal places. And the coefficient of variation is a number to two decimal places. Good. Okay, so now I can copy this across. Okay, so now we've got in order Dow, S&P 500, NASDAQ. Dow, S&P 500, Dow average 9.38%, S&P average 10.12%, NASDAQ average 14.42%. You see it? And look at the standard deviations. Do you see the relationship between risk and return? It's right there. The principle that I've been beefing about all semester. The greater the risk, the greater the expected return. Historically, the rule stands. The Dow is giant, massive, bloated, 30 of the biggest behemoths on earth. Low-risk companies, low expected return. S&P 500, 500 companies in monopolistic competition, aggressive, fighting, working hard, hiring people like you, average is higher. But, of course, then the standard deviation is higher. And then the NASDAQ, the little scrappy companies, most of them are. There are some big, huge companies. But look at that massive standard deviation on that. Now, here's the weird thing, though. Look at the coefficients of variation. Do you notice that the Standard & Poor's 500 really isn't much riskier by CV measure than the Dow 30. Do you see it? Do you see that the Dow 30 and Standard & Poor's 500 both have scaled to the level of their returns the same level of risk, which actually means which would probably be a more intelligent investment. If you were to create a portfolio, maybe buy an ETF, Would you buy an ETF of the Dow 30 or an ETF of the Standard & Poor's 500? Yeah, S&P 500, because clearly you're bearing about the same level of risk for a better return. And that's largely because the Dow 30, they are actually not particularly great companies. They're huge, they're oligopolies, which means that they don't really create, they aren't competitors with each other. They function in a strategic world. So between those two, the S&P 500 is actually a better portfolio. But of course, if you want to take the ride, there's your NASDAQ. Beautiful example right there. Higher, noticeably higher expected, higher return historically. And of course, by either standard deviation or CV, coefficient of variation, yeah, it's riskier. But notice something else interesting. If you look at just the standard deviation, do you see that the NASDAQ looks like it is quite a bit riskier? But if you look at it scaled by the size of the returns, it's really not that much riskier. So that gives you an idea of some of the metrics that are good for us to use in our business. Now, the one thing that is, of course, going to be part of your consideration, you're going to invest in a portfolio. That's good. The one thing that you want to do is you have to appreciate that when you add stocks to a portfolio, the risk of two stocks is not just the weighted average of the risk of the two stocks taken individually. The return, the expected return is, but the risk has some nasty little twists in it. For one thing, the extent to which two stocks are correlated makes the risk worse. So in other words, if I've got two stocks and I put them together and they're highly correlated, they're going to make each other worse. You, madam, are an axe murderer. I really actually know this because, you know, like, there's some CCTV that it's obviously you, and I mean, that cow in that field, you really, that cow did nothing to you. Okay, you, madam, are an arsonist. I put you two together, I do not mitigate a darn bit of risk. You two are a dangerous pair. You burn the house, you axe the people inside. That's awful, man. So what I need to do is get someone like you to work with one of you, because you don't do any of that. You make apple pies and cream custards. And you also take care of homeless bunny rabbits. You are going to tame this person. You're going to tame that person. You were going to burn down a house today, but you decide, no, I don't want to, because I saw his bunnies and I petted them and they were so, so cute. Okay? I was going to get my axe out, but how could I do that? He's making pie. I don't need an axe to slice it, just a little knife. Ice cream, you know, a little bit of caramel on top. Anyway, okay, do you see what I'm saying is, now, let me show you. How do we look for this? I'm going to go to Google here. And this is called the Portfolio Visualizer, but I don't have its URL, Portfolio Visualizer. Here it is, portfoliovisualizer.com. Portfolio Visualizer. Let me see if I can find the... okay, here it is. portfoliovisualizer.com/asset-correlations. Now, here you can punch in companies by their ticker symbol. So, just a few. Caterpillar, Facebook, Netflix, Kellogg. What else? Apple, APP, is it AAPL? Ford. Start date, we're just going to let it go the way it is. View the correlations. Here are the correlation coefficients. Now you tend, everyone's going to tell you a threshold. Mine is about 0.3. You don't want any correlations between two stocks in your portfolio to be above 0.3. Other people say 0.2. Some people say 0.5. Okay, notice, Caterpillar would work with any in this portfolio except for Apple and Ford. Caterpillar would work with Facebook because they don't have anything in common. It would work with Netflix for the same reason, Kroger. But Caterpillar actually has a rather strong correlation with Apple and a very strong correlation with another heavy industrial company, Facebook. Now, if I look at Netflix, for example, you notice that actually Netflix works with almost all, with any of the companies. You could have them both in the portfolio. They would not cause each other trouble. You follow it? That's how you create your portfolio. One last thing I need to do here for you today, if you will bear with me 1 minute, show you this. Okay, here we go. Here's your surprise quiz. By the way, I will extend the Chapter 8 homework due date until Tuesday night. Let you guys catch up a little bit here.